Welcome to the St. Emlyn's podcast. I'm Ian Beardsall.
And I'm Simon Cowley.
Welcome back to the podcast. It's been a little while, Simon. We've both been busy. We've been doing things. And you've been off travelling, doing lots of exciting conferences. And I've been in the midst of what we like to describe as GCSE revision. Not me, obviously. I have passed my GCSEs, but I have a son who is working hard at his. So it's been a busy time. How have you been?
Very good. I have been all over the place, as you say. I've been to Switzerland. I've been to Whistler in Canada. I've been to Graz in Austria. I've been to Iceland, which is a holiday. And I'm about to go to Wales. So I'm really quite excited about this sort of thing. And I really, if anybody's out there who wants to manage my diary better than I can, that would be great, because it has been a bit of a struggle to fit everything in.
I have always thought of you as a bit like Hermione in Harry Potter, where you need one of those time turner things where there's basically two of you, or you go back and do it a second time. I don't know how you do it. I can't, but good luck to you. And I do, dear listener, I keep an eye on his health. We look at each other on a camera, and if he's sweating a lot when we record, I ask him to see his general practitioner. Now, we just want to mention two other conferences that are coming up that we are partnering up with. The first one is not far away at all. It's the Premier Conference, and this is hosted in Winchester by the Wessex team, Pediatric, Medical and Major Trauma Emergencies. A great conference. We went to it last year. You may remember some of the podcasts we did from it. Highly recommended. There are early bird prices available until the 1st of May. Winchester is a lovely place to visit, and the dates for that are the 11th and 12th of June. So not far away, but a lovely time to come and visit the beautiful ancient city of Winchester. So that's the first one we'd like to recommend. And the second, an incredibly exciting conference, which we're so pleased we've been invited to go to podcast from and blog from and do some other bits from, the Tactical Trauma Conference 24. And this is in Sweden in October. It's had a little hiatus because of COVID, but it's back. 3-day conference with workshops, followed by 2 days of lectures and other presentations. And this is all about working in high-stakes environments relating to mainly pre-hospital trauma and critical care, but with a sort of tactical twist. And they've got lots of people from outside medicine coming to speak. So if you're at all interested in pre-hospital emergency medicine, the world, as we've seen all too obviously recently, is changing. And these sorts of conferences are becoming more and more necessary, where we need to know how to manage these quite difficult and, well, high pressure events. Then get yourself to Sweden, search up on the website. There will be a link on our page as well. So Tactical Trauma 24, the Premier Conference, both are coming up, both highly recommended.
Absolutely. And there'll be a few other conferences that we'll be visiting and reporting back from this year. I put up a report from the Graz conference, which is on the website now.
So today, Simon, we're going to try something a little different. Instead of doing our usual monthly update, we are going to do something similar to how I first experienced online learning. Cliff Reed introduced me to emergency medicine abstracts way back when I was a registrar and he was a consultant in Basingstoke. And they used to send out a CD every month. This was Jerry Hoffman and Rick Bucata would do 40 papers in a month, and they do short abstracts. Now, this is similar to the talk that Simon gave when he went to the conference in Zermatt, and we are going to try to cover 20 papers in this podcast. So if you're into your evidence-based medicine, today is the day. This is your moment. We're going to do our best. I don't know that we'll quite do it in the same way or as well as Jerry and Rick used to do it, who are frankly legends, but we're going to give it our go. So head down, listen in. Evidence-based medicine, huge update coming up. Paper one, an observational study entitled Emergency Department versus Operating Room Intubation of Patients Undergoing Immediate Hemorrhage Control Surgery. This was published in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery in 2023. And it goes a bit like this. Simon.
One of the dilemmas that we sometimes have, both pre-hospitally and in the emergency department, is for those patients who come in, particularly from significant trauma where you think they're bleeding, and they've also got a knocked-up GCS that may be difficult to manage. And you're thinking, well, actually, do I need to intubate this patient? Do I need to anaesthetize them now? Or do I hold off? My worry always is that if you fail to resuscitate these people before you give them the drugs and RSI them, they'll just crash an induction and die. And so that's been a common theme throughout my training and education, is really, particularly for things like the penetrating trauma patients who you think are bleeding, try not to get put to sleep until you're really, really the door of the theatre with the surgeon in front of you, scrubbed up and ready to go. And I think there's probably some logic behind that. But evidence-wise, it's always been a bit of a feeling, what is the evidence for it? So what these guys did is they looked over just under 10,000 patients, 9,667 patients, observational study looking at where patients who were bleeding, so that was defined as patients who were going pretty much to theatre within, I think, about an hour, where they got intubated, whether they got intubated in the ED or whether they got intubated in the operating room. And then they looked at mortality. 253 trauma centres, 9,667 patients. There was a 20% increase in mortality if they got tubed in the ED as opposed to in the operating room. So that kind of backs up what I thought in terms of it's dangerous to do it before you're at the point where you can actually surgically fix the bleeding problem. The other interesting things was that if you obviously intubate them in the ED, you spent longer in the emergency department, you had more transfusion, you ended up with more complications. Patients are variable, so they tried to adjust for this. So even after adjusting for patient factors, the difference remained with an increased risk of death of 1.85 on the adjusted odds ratio. You might be sitting there going, oh, well, evidence-based medicine observational study, maybe it was because the patients were sicker. The ones who were most sick got tubed in the ED, and that's why they died more often. So they went back into the data again, and they tried to look at what was actually wrong with them. And they looked at the patient mix, and they looked at the reasons why the patients got intubated. And they found the biggest difference and the biggest reason for people getting intubated in the ED was about the natural practice of that department. So there are some departments which do this all the time, and the other departments that wait until you get to the operating room. And so this appears to be culture and practice which are influencing the decision more than the needs of the patient. And that decision is associated, not proven, but heavily associated with increased mortality. So the conclusion from this is not the best evidence in the world, but we're never going to get a randomized controlled trial of this. For your bleeding patients who are shocked, who need to go to theatre soon, take them to theatre and do the RSI there.
Fascinating paper, Simon. And it does make us think a little bit about what we do in the emergency department and pre-hospital, actually. Although, let's be honest, this was not about pre-hospital intubation of bleeding patients. It was about emergency department, but maybe there's, again, an observation there. A couple of things to note. This was often penetrating trauma. So 70% were penetrating injuries, which is maybe different to what we see in the UK. It was observational. And the mean initial GCS and systolic blood pressure for this patient was 15 for their GCS and 108 millimeters of mercury. So these are not the patients who are massively hypotensive, but there is definitely a signal there that maybe we should wait. Paper number two. This is one we've covered already. Very much worth quicker discussion, but we have had further discussion about this on the podcast before. This is video versus direct laryngoscopy for tracheal intubation in critical adults, published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
So in brief, this has been a long-running thing, hasn't it, about whether or not we should be using VL first or DL first. What this paper did, it was a randomized controlled trial looking at emergency department intubation. Their outcome was first pass success, comparing the two. It was known as the DeVice trial. And essentially what they showed is that if you used a VL, your first pass success rate was 85.1%. And if you used DL, direct laryngoscopy, it was 70.8%. That's clinically and statistically important. And therefore, you know, it's an interesting finding. Couple of caveats. Firstly, the difference disappeared after you've done about 100 intubations. So if you're a very experienced intubator, the difference probably isn't that great. But for teaching and for learning, absolutely fantastic. And if you're an infrequent intubator, which many of us are, absolutely, it's the way to go, isn't it? And Scott Weingart's got a great MCRIT podcast, which sort of reinforced this even before the paper came out. I think this is a good evidence that we should probably be going for VL first in the emergency department setting.
I have to admit, I'm a big VL convert. I've moved over to it in the last couple of years. Really like it, think it's really useful. And actually, the other day, I ended up using a direct laryngoscopy and found it a little bit uncomfortable. But we've covered it before. VL, great thing for both intubating and teaching. Think about using it if you're not already. Next paper, paper three. So this is the effect of laryngoscope blade size on first pass success in tracheal intubation in critical ill adults, critical care explorations.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting one because this has been a debate which has been running locally about which blade should you use in your average size person. There are seem to be two schools of thought. One is that you should pick up a grade, a size 4 Macintosh blade for all your patients because you can pretty much intubate anybody with a Mac 4, which is true. And then the other school of thought, which is that you should probably size the blade for the size of the patient and use the appropriate size. In this study, what they did in critical care patients is they did observational data, and again, it's observational data, so always be cautious about that kind of thing. They looked at what the success rate, as defined by first pass success, was, depending on whether people chose to use a 3 or a 4. So the idea is that if you're somebody who chooses to use a smaller blade, then maybe you're the sort of person who gets a better success rate. Or maybe if you just use a 4 all the time, maybe you don't. So what they found was that quite significantly, the view, the Cormac-Lehane view, and the first pass success rate was higher if you'd chosen to use a grade as a size 3 blade. This is really interesting because if you then delve into it in a bit more detail and go right back to when Macintosh actually invented the blade, it was pretty much a size 3 blade. The size 4 blade was only added later on, several years later, when they discovered that very large humans couldn't be intubated with a 3. So the standard blade is probably about the size of a 3 for the vast majority of people, and a 4 is for big people. There's also some mechanical advantages to why you would want to use a 3 rather than a 4. But interestingly, this has been one of the most controversial things I've put out on Twitter in ages. I mentioned it a few days ago and it's just gone viral. So the anesthetic world is very upset. Well, half of it is. The other half thinks it's great. My personal feeling is that particularly for women now, I'm going to use a 3, not use a 4. And for smaller chinned men, such as myself, I'll use a 3, but I'll have a 4 available. The only downside to this is potentially that if you are measuring first pass success as your outcome measure for success in RSIs, as your key performance indicator, which many services do, then if you put a 4 in, you can probably intubate everybody. If you put a 3 in, then, well, you know, maybe you're going to have to change it if it's not big enough. The second thing about this is all direct laryngoscopy. So we don't know whether you get the same effect if you were doing it with size 3 and size 4 video laryngoscopes.
Interesting stuff. Paper number 4. This is the association of small adult ventilation bags with return of spontaneous circulation and out of hospital cardiac arrest. This comes from Resuscitation in December 2023. And I must admit, this is a new one on me.
Well, not in my part of the world. There has been great concern based on some really not brilliant evidence about 5-6 years ago that we were overventilating, hyperventilating patients in cardiac arrest, and that was leading to adverse outcomes. You know, we know that hypocapnia can cause changes to both coronary and particularly cerebral perfusion, and maybe that was a worse thing for our patients. It always confused me a little bit. Our patients in cardiac arrest have usually, when I look at the blood gas, they've usually got a mixed metabolic respiratory acidosis, and particularly a profound metabolic acidosis. And the natural defense mechanism of the body is to then give yourself hypocapnia and a respiratory alkalosis. But anyway, putting that to one side, what it meant is that a large number of services around the world decided to move over from using an adult-sized BVM to a pediatric-sized BVM to avoid people hyperventilating the patient. So it put a mechanical barrier in the way of the person doing the ventilation to overventilate the patient. And one of the biggest services to do this, and the most famous one, was Seattle. And of course, Seattle is so famous for how well they manage their cardiac arrest. They've had a brilliant database. They've got one of the best ROSCs and best survivals from cardiac arrest in the world. And they did this several years ago. And what they did then is they followed the data through and had a look about whether or not it made a difference, thinking that, well, if the data is right, if the pathophysiological argument is correct, we'll get more survivors. But they didn't. They had 1,994 patients, of which 1,331 were treated with a small bag. And the rate of ROSC went down after they introduced the smaller bags. So it was lower, 33% versus 40%. And then when you adjusted for various different things about case mix and stuff, it was still there, statistically important, with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.74 for your survival. Now, I think that's really interesting. So this means that you've taken a pathophysiological argument, you've made a change, it's got worse. Other interesting things, it was over COVID. You may say, oh, well, it was a COVID effect. They looked at the data that they acquired before COVID and during. There was no difference. It was the same effect all the way through. So it may be that this drive for us to use smaller bags and to hypoventilate our patients in cardiac arrest is the wrong thing to do. Observational data need more stuff, but yes, really good that they looked at their data after the intervention and are questioning whether they made the right decision.
The data is observational again. And Simon, do you think you're going to move back to the larger adult bags now or stick with what you've got?
So I think that's a really interesting question. I think we'll probably move back to the larger bags, but there's a better question to ask, which is how do we monitor and how do we assess the effectiveness of CPR in practice? So at the moment, and this is another conversation for another day, at the moment we're obsessed with doing what I call process measures. So people measure whether you're going up and down the chest and whether you're going around the cycles, whether you're doing ALS. There's some really good work from children that what we should be doing is physiologically assessing the performance of our CPR. So we need physiological data to do that. Very good data from PICUs in the US. There's some really interesting work being done in the UK around pre-hospital work, particularly the SPHERE project with EAAA. I think that's the way forward. End-tidal CO2 is not a great measure. It's a bit of a random number generator in reality compared to what the actual blood gases are in cardiac arrest and in a lot of our sick patients. Watch this space. I think we'll be doing things differently in about 3 or 4 years' time.
Paper number 5. This is the effect of non-invasive airway management on comatose patients with acute poisoning, a randomized controlled trial. This is from JAMA in December 2023. This is about tracheal intubation in coma patients where they've had some form of acute poisoning. Simon?
Yeah, so French study, nice, big numbers. And basically what they showed there is if you do a watch and wait policy for this group of patients, it's probably safe to do so. A proportion will still need to get tubed, but actually you can avoid intubating a lot of patients who've just been poisoned. Quite a lot of those patients were alcohol. And I think we probably know that. We actually watched quite a few of those patients. I'm very keen on the concept of trajectory. So when you first see them, the GCS might be a bit low, but watch them for 10, 20, 30 minutes. If they're getting better, great. If they're getting worse, tube them. If they're staying the same, make a decision.
This is one of those tricky ones, isn't it? Where in the emergency department, sometimes it helps if the patient is intubated, because then you know where they're going next. Watching and waiting in our ED recess room is a tricky thing to do, but we kind of need that middle ground, don't we? A ED, ITU type interface where some patients get better over a short period of time, but need to be allowed a little bit more than the 4 or maybe 6 hours that we allow them. And this group is up there. Another one I always find is DKA, where they do turn around pretty fast, but not often fast enough to satisfy some of the targets that we're aiming to hit. Interesting stuff. If you've got a patient who's poisoned, particularly with alcohol, you may be able to not need to intubate them. Next paper, paper number 6. This is mild hypercapnia or normocapnia after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, a randomized controlled trial, again from the New England Journal of Medicine in 2023. Big fan of us getting these papers into the larger journals. Lovely to see. And perhaps this supports a little bit what we were talking about with the bag size earlier on, Simon.
Big RCT. The idea was that a bit of hypercapnia might improve your cerebral perfusion. And so that was the options. In fact, it made no difference. So 1,700 patients randomized into this trial. And mild hypercapnia, there was no difference in outcome. So it's not something we're going to be pursuing at this stage.
Nice quick one. And on to the final one of our airway type papers. This is the one about prevalence of peri-intubation major adverse events among critically ill patients, American Journal of Emergency Medicine, September last year, 2023.
There's a couple of interesting things in this. I mean, the headline figure from this is when you look at intubation of critically ill patients in terms of adverse effects of things like hypoxia, hypotension, cardiovascular collapse, cardiac arrest, you know, it's quite common. They had 34,000 plus intubations outside of the operating room in this study, and they described a 30% major adverse outcome rate. So the first thing is, yes, this is a dodgy group of patients to be intubating, and you've got to be really careful and make sure that you know what you're doing. The second is, whenever I look at, and this is going to sound awful, but whenever I look at papers outside of what I would consider to be high-performing system, particularly around airway care, is I'm always shocked about how high the adverse event rates is and how low things like first-pass success rates are. If I look at some of the services in, you know, like London HEMS, Sydney HEMS, you know, other really good services which have looked at their figures and have a highly trained population, they seem to perform a lot better than the average, because this is telling us what the average is. The lesson I've got from that is that we can probably do better. A 30% major adverse event rate is not in every single service. It's not with everybody. So we have to be able to do better with these very, very scary and very difficult group of patients. So make sure you've got the right people in the room with the right training, and don't be afraid to call for help when you've got these patients, because it's all about the patient. It's not about ego or who owns the airway, because at the end of the day, the patient owns the airway.
So that brings us to the end of theme one, which is airways. And we've covered an awful lot there. So just a very brief recap. Whether you're going to intubate patients in the operating room or operating theatre versus in ED, well, it seems to be the push that the evidence would say that resuscitate your patient as fully as possible, particularly in patients with penetrating trauma who are bleeding. It's probably an idea to get them to the operating room, operating theatre, and intubate them there. The evidence seems to be pushing us in that direction. When you are intubating, there's a fairly good signal that video laryngoscopy is the way to go. Not only is this good for people who don't intubate a lot, it's also a fabulous teaching aid. The effect of the laryngoscope blade, well, this was direct laryngoscopy. Size 3 may well be the one you need to go for if you're still using DL. The jury is still out on whether that's the same for video laryngoscopy. If you've moved to small adult ventilation bags for cardiac arrest, this may be something you want to think about, going back to the larger bags, because there isn't really the benefit that perhaps physiologically we thought. That relates to paper 6, where we've seen that the actual difference between normocapnia and mild hypercapnia in patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest really makes no difference to their outcome. So that fits together with that. If you've got patients who are comatose from poisoning, particularly alcohol, diving into intubate early may make things more tricky. And then finally, there are plenty of reasons that intubation can go wrong. It is an event that can be associated with things getting worse and not better. So having the best people in the room to make the decision about when to intubate, whether pre-hospital or in hospital, is the way forward. That's a lot about airways. Lots to take in as ever. Please go and read the papers. Don't just take mine and Simon's word for it. And that brings us to the end of our first part of this mammoth paper review. 20 papers in 2 episodes, split in half just to make them manageable. We'll see you again for part 2 very soon. Thank you.